Welcome to Changelog, Episode 6. I'm Chris, your bumbling game designer. Today I'm speaking with Michelle Nicolaisen about corruption and redemption, paganism in games, hacking games, and jumping into the deep end. Are you ready, IntroBot?
Let's begin!
So hello and welcome to Changelog. I'm Chris and I'm here with Michelle Nicolaisen.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for being on. We connected a few months ago through a mutual Twitter friend named Alice, and I've wanted to have you on since then, but it's been crazy and I had to rewrite my whole game. So we're here now, though. Just for everybody else, everybody, because they all know mine at this point, and if they don't, oh well, it's fine. What pronouns would you like to be referred to as?
I prefer they, them.
Okay. When we start this, it's always the icebreaker question is always ends up being the meat of the show, which is fine, and it'll springboard us into the boring parts, which is where I have to talk about my nonsense. So the first question I have for you is when you are looking at a game or reading a game or making a game, what's one aspect of it that you're like, oh, that's a Michelle game?
So two things come to mind. Well, one of them is like super vague, I guess. But I like, I don't even know how to word it. I guess mechanics that allow for redemption. I know that there are, there's a couple, and it really depends. I've seen people play it out in different ways, but I know that there are mechanics in, like, for example, both Urban Shadows and also like Monster of the Week. And, like, I understand to some extent, like, why those mechanics are the way they are. But like, for me personally, as both a player and like a DM, I really am drawn more to games that allow for like some kind of redemption arc or a narrative or something that's less like, okay, well, like now you're out of XYZ currency and you're a bad guy, or like you're going to die, in the case of Monster of the Week, or I guess it's, you know, it's a little loosey goosey there.
Yeah.
But something like that.
You could definitely, you could 100% use it as a redemption arc if you were. I know 7th C literally has like corruption and redemption arcs built in, where you have to do a story arc to get rid of your corruption, I think, which I always thought was pretty cool.
Oh, that, yeah, I'll have to look that up.
Yeah. So redemption arcs are great. You said you had two, though, right?
Yeah, I think the other one is that, like, I'm really interested in, I'm trying to think of like how to word this. So I'm interested in how games use magic and like supernatural elements, but I'm specifically interested in, this is one of the reasons that Serendipity City is set in the 1920s, because I'm pagan, and I've been pagan for like more of my life than not, which was a weird realization to have a couple years ago. And yeah, especially growing up, like where and when I did, because I grew up in very rural southwestern Missouri, and I moved out of there in like 2009. So I think that magic is interesting. And obviously, even though most of the time the magic that shows up in a game does not look like quote unquote IRL magic or like my spiritual practice, it's always really interesting to me when games like very clearly intentionally move away from sort of the like the more stereotypical like Hogwarts magic style of magic, right, or like the very, very D&D influenced like system of like patronage, and have like a magic and or like for the classes that are built around spirituality based magic, have something that is like closer to my experience and kind of like marry that to more of a like modern day experience, instead of being like the only place in which this magic exists is someplace that's like, you know, clearly meant to be an analog to our Middle Ages at some place that's so far away. But like, right, for me, and coming from the background and the lived experience that I have, like magic and spirituality are very, very concrete everyday things, and I think it's interesting to play with that in a game, and instead of it being like this kind of abstract, like only like flashy bangy kind of thing.
Yeah, like the more, I hate to say mundane magic, but that's kind of what I mean, I guess. Like day to day, like.
Yeah, like, you know, the way, like, day-to-day, like, interactions with, like, deities or, like, tarot readings or, you know, just, like, something, like, I'm really interested in seeing, and even when it is, like, Hogwarts-y magic, I'm interested in seeing, like, the interplay of, like, magic and technology and, like, something that's closer to our everyday life as is now.
Yeah, which is, I want to talk about Serendipity City in this vein, but before I get there, have you ran into any games in the wild that actually do magic in a way that you find interesting, or has it just been you making it your own in your system?
I do like the way that Monster of the Week does it, mm-hmm. partially because, like, there are different, well, one of the things that I really like about Monster of the Week is that it allows for a class that is, like, a fighty class as well as a magical class, which is, like, just all of my favorite things, whereas, like, in a lot of, you know, in systems that are, like, D&D or more very, very influenced by D&D, it's, like, you can have a magical character, but they kind of suck at everything else. And I like the way that Monster of the Week sort of approaches that, like, framework wise, where the details are very, like, left open to both the DM and the player.
Especially in, like, big magic, where it's literally just like, let's make this thing happen. Like, let's figure out what it takes to make this work.
Yeah. Versus, like, you get one of these three spells and, like, the spells are, like, you know, teleportation and, like, lightning bolt or whatever. So that's one of the things I'm taking. That's one of the things that I'm, like, kind of trying to take inspiration for the PBTA hack that I'm working on, is having, like, a magic quote unquote system, if you can even call it that, because it's so loose. Which I also realize might be, like, a playability barrier, because I don't know if that's, it's been, like, it is really interesting thinking about this stuff and then talking to, like, other people, because, you know, I feel like in general, if people are presented with, like, you can do magic, they're like, what kind, what can I do?
Yeah. In yours, is, do you have to have a magic playbook to use magic? Because that's something I liked about magic in Monster of the Week, and it's something I put in my game, which is, magic is something you don't have, like, the wizard, having to have a wizard class to use magic always annoyed me, because it bakes in that kind of, like, oh, you're born magic or you're not, like Harry Potter, you're a muggle or you're a wizard, and that's bullshit. I think everybody, if you're gonna have magic, you should at least, people should be able to touch that at some level. And I think that's very interesting in Monster of the Week, because technically anybody can, but if you want to play a character who is specifically non-magical, you just never roll that move.
And I'm kind of structuring it something similar. I have like a bunch of different playbooks. Oof, my playbook draft list is currently, I haven't figured out quite how to, like, narrow this down yet. I have a list of games to look at, because the general idea that I have right now is, I'm pulling up this list, I think it's like six core playbooks and then with, like, variants of each one. Oh no, it's more than, oops, it's it's eight core playbooks, and then with each one you have like 2 to 3 different background options. I don't know if this will work. I don't know if that's, like, an overwhelming amount, but I was surprised because I was like, maybe this is too many, and then I went like Monster of the Week and like Dungeon World and the Sprawl, like, they have, I don't know about the Sprawl actually, but I think that Dungeon World has, like, more than this. And Monster of the Week has several too. But so, yeah, it's a sort of a similar thing where it's like, okay, if you are, like, the Seer, if you're playing the Seer playbook, then you can, like, get a bonus, on, you know, get a bonus is, like, used loosely. Again, this is all pretty rough right now, but, like, you will be more likely to succeed at, like, getting a successful prophecy, but anyone, regardless of background, even if your playbook is, like, the architect, which is somebody who is much more like mundane technology than magically oriented, you can still, like, do magic, because why, especially if you exist in a world where magic is there, why wouldn't you be able to?
I think that's great and the way to go about it. Also, I think the question of do I have too many playbooks is pretty easily answered, in that, like, once someone makes a PPTA game, you'll see a million other people make playbooks for it. Like, there will be hundreds of playbooks for one game. So I think the philosophy behind PPTA games and how many playbooks you need, it's how many do you need to get your themes across?
Yeah.
So I think you're safe no matter how many you decide to make. It's just a lot of work on your end.
It is, yeah. And, like, this whole, like, the background thing is interesting because it's, like, what I'm kind of getting at, like, the way that I'm thinking of the playbooks is, like, sort of, I don't even know if theme is the right word, but, like, for example, I have, like, a seer playbook, and then for the background options, I was thinking, like, an oracle, which would be, like, your standard crystal ball, tarot, like, that kind of thing, or, mm-hmm. like, a necromancer, which is, there's, like, a whole subset of divination that is like talking to the dead to get information. Right. So that would be like that kind of necromancer, not like literally raising the dead.
Yeah.
But then I have like a muscle playbook, which has, you know, a couple different backgrounds, like someone who's been trained in martial arts, someone who has not been trained in martial arts, but is just like very fighty. I don't even know if like themes is the right word, but I've kind of like grouped them under these headings because I feel like, yeah. I feel like in general, people go into a game and they're like, okay, I want to play regardless of the themes of the game. Like when I open, and this might just be me being like predictable bisexual trash, but when I open a playbook, I'm like, okay, I want to play someone who is like good at magic and good at stealing and maybe like, oh, at least okay at fighting. Yeah. And then from there, like I might get some ideas, but I very rarely stray too far outside of that niche. Mm-hmm. So my thinking is like, okay, I'm going to like give people a way to find like the thing they want, maybe take it in like a slightly different direction. So if you're mm-hmm. usually play like a fighter, you have the option of being like, okay, like, you know, a couple different options there. And then the rest of the mechanics will hopefully like push you in some more interesting directions. This is my theory. I guess we'll see.
I hope you're correct because funnily enough, I have the same kind of breakdown in my game. I have 10 jobs, and each job has, you know, their specific job ability that reinforces the theme I made up for that overarching job. But really where your customization is, each of them have three different all backgrounds. Some of them are like for the enforcer, it was basically your three backgrounds. Like which one of these things did you do for the organization you were a part of? And that kind of like silos you off into like, so all enforcers are good at this, but you're good at this. And yeah. So it's like, it's to help with choice paralysis. Yeah. I imagine like if I just showed people 30 characters they could play, that'd be like, oh.
Yeah. Well, and like once you know, so one of the things that I thought was interesting, like looking at other PBTA games that are like urban fantasy oriented, especially, and again, like this is one of those things that it might not make sense to someone else because of like my specific background, because there have definitely been times in Serendipity City and where like a lot of the mythology is influenced by like my beliefs and like my mythology, spirituality, whatever, and people are like, there's a moment in one of the games where I said something about the Fae and this character's like, so they're evil? And I'm like, I mean, like, not real. Like, and he's like, but like, they aren't like, stop it. Like this person is like hurting somebody else or like is not like super concerned. And it's like, okay, but like, is, you know, is a natural disaster evil? Like, is a tiger evil? Like they're not human. You can't ascribe human morality to like non-human creatures in a one-to-one way. Like it just doesn't work that way. So I don't know if this will be something similar where I've organized it in a way that makes more sense to me. But one of the things that I did think was interesting is that in looking at other games where it was possible to play them urban fantasy style versus like old school fantasy, high fantasy, the playbooks were often grouped in ways that like didn't make sense to me coming from that perspective. So I have like I have a playbook that's the wild, and like the common theme there is like a strong link to nature. So that would be like where your druid character is, where your elemental is, or like your shapeshifter. And then I have a background that's, you know, a playbook that's like the beguiler. I don't know if I'm actually saying that right, but that's like that where right. your like fae or like a bard style character is, because those, the thing that like unites those two like character archetypes is generally that they're charismatic and like good at persuading people, even if like with a bard it's via like magical music basically, and with the fae mm-hmm. it's through like glamour or yeah. magical subterfuge. They're still good at charming people.
I think that all pretty solidly tracks, but also I'm not sure, it may just make sense to me because I've read entirely too many games, and like I can see the anybody who's like followed a bunch of different story, and I don't know about you, but my brain automatically sorts things into boxes even when I don't want it to.
Yeah.
So that could possibly be why it makes sense for me.
Well, and I think I'm hoping, if nothing else, that it makes sense when it's read. Right. So we'll see.
It's a problem of game design is like, how do you, and this is like the biggest problem of game design, because like you can come up with ideas, you can have great ideas all the time and be amazing. You just have these great ideas and you can run that game perfectly because it's your ideas and you understand it intrinsically. But how do you conveying that idea as you have it in your mind to another person with completely different perspectives as you is wild. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, and it's funny because it's like, this is like the big problem of like basically any profession or craft that involves people, right? Because this is like the problem with like design, like UX design. Okay, like mm-hmm. you know what those icons mean, but does like random Joe over there, or like writing, like, okay, you understood what was supposed to be implied there, but does someone, you know, or even like marketing copy, like is it getting the point across? So. Yeah, I guess that's where feedback comes in. Yep. Hopefully. Fingers crossed.
So this will hopefully springboard into another topic we want to get to. But I specifically wanted to talk to you about just how freaking by storm you took this hobby. So I was listening, one of our friend Alice referred me to your podcast, Serendipity City, and like I was like, okay, fine. I mean, I have too many APs right now, but I'll give it a check. And I started listening to it, and like in the first episode I found out like you hadn't been role playing, like I think you said you'd been role playing like a year.
Yeah.
And this was your first time GMing, I think.
Yep.
And you were doing PBTA, which by itself isn't too wild. It is for someone who is an author, which I believe you're an author, right?
That was
your original. Okay, your original jaunt into creativity.
Yeah,
maybe not original, but it's something you do. For like a writer, someone who understands story, PBTA is pretty not that wild to go into. But you didn't just do PBTA. You took the player section from one PBTA game and the GM section from another PBTA game, and then you're like, I'm gonna do all this on air with people watching.
Yeah. I don't know why I'm like this. It's like, I think that it's like, I want to say it's a personality trait. I don't know, like, but I genuinely do not know where it comes from. Like my first, and it is a problem because I do like to bite off like more than I can chew. And then I get halfway through something and I'm like, maybe this was not a very good idea. One of the reasons that we're still on hiatus is because I'm like working on the game design process, which like, honestly, to get something, like we've already been playing a pretty hacked together version, like you said. So it will probably not be huge. Mm-hmm. Especially because since what we're doing is like ignores large chunks of both Urban Shadows and the Sprawl, it is not always a seamless player experience. So I doubt that this will be any more confusing. But yeah, like the first novel that I wrote was the first book in a trilogy, and now I'm like halfway through the second book, and I have, you know, I'm also like, I have like a scripted podcast and also a full-time job and et cetera, et cetera. Well, so like I had the idea, I wanted to do something. I've always been really interested in interactive storytelling, and I don't know why, but it took me a really long time to realize that that's what like tabletop RPG games are. I didn't like I said, I grew up in this like very my graduating class in high school was 65 people.
I actually have you beat. I think I had like 87 or something.
Yeah. So like, you know, and I think Joplin might have a game store, but it was very like old school gamey, and I didn't have any friends who were into it. I was like the very weird kid. Like I was already like the Satan worshiping like lesbian communist at school. So like I did not have anyone who would be like, hey, you want to hang out and play? I mean, like, I don't think anyone at that school played anything like D&D. And I started listening to The Adventure Zone and Friends at the Table, and like listening to, I was like, oh, like I understand. Like I understand.
It clicked into place.
Yeah. I was like, oh, I get it. I understand this. I understand the appeal. And it's, yeah, like I said, it's funny because one of the first RPGs I ever played was Chrono Cross, which like, it still has a special place in my heart. And you know, like spoiled me for a lot of other RPGs. Like,
yeah, it's a really high, it sets a high bar.
Yeah. Yeah. So I tried to play something else after that. That was just kind of like a cookie cutter JRPG. Like, oh no, we have to save the world from this evil emperor. And I was like, this is not what I want. But when I first started playing Chrono Cross, I was like 10 and I was extremely excited. I was like, oh my God, this is like a book that you can see, but it's not like a book, but you get to actually like do it. I was a very dorky child, and
like, hoops amongst us was not.
Yeah. So, and that's something that I've been interested in, but have like, and I had played with the idea of like Twine games for a while, like before I had like come across actual plays. And then, you know, I'm listening and I'm just like, oh my God, like this is like really the, like, I don't want to say the ultimate because that like sets up a hierarchy, but this is like, very much interactive storytelling. Like you can't,
it's literally like all the other artifices of it fall apart and that's almost all it is. There are other parts, there's like, there are mechanics and stuff behind it, but that's, it is interactive storytelling. That's the game.
Yeah. And I think the moment that like, I don't think that there's a lot of this, especially early on in like Taz, but like I started listening to Friends at the Table probably because Griffin mentioned it on Taz or something. And there's a part early on in Friends at the Table that was like a huge light bulb moment for me where, you know, one of the players is like, I think it literally starts from someone mishearing somebody else. And one of the players is like, did you just say that's a dead pirate ship, like a ship of pirate zombies? And Austin is like, actually, yeah, that's a lot cooler than what I had in mind. And then that like spawns this whole other, like, you know, he's talking later and he's like, yeah, I had to go back home and like change all of my prep and the world docs and blah, blah, blah. But that spawns this like whole other thing, which like now, you know, some ridiculous 5 years later or whatever is this whole intricate mythology. And I'm just like, wow, that was because of like an offhand comment by a player. And then like everybody agreed to just like, yes, and the hell out of it. And now here we are. Like, that's amazing.
Yeah. I think the it's the old adage of like, just actually, I don't remember what the adage is, but it's like one brain is never going to come up with as many good ideas as 10 brains.
Yeah.
And so on and so forth. And I think like there's also like a creative energy that gets if you in like, as long as you don't have someone around saying no to everything.
Yeah.
And as long as you don't have someone saying yes to literally everything, as long as there's like-minded people, the people who kind of jive on the same wavelength, when you get a bunch of people together being creative, it just kind of makes this feedback of creativity that I find extremely fulfilling creatively.
Yeah. Yeah, it's so much fun. And yeah, so that was like part of what like really grabbed me. And I like kind of, you know, had this idea for doing something more urban fantasy because of all of the previous mentioned stuff. I wanted to, you know, I'm like, a lot of the stuff is great, but a lot of it is also, again, outside of like, you know, Friends at the Table has some other stuff, but, like a lot of this is very, especially at the time, when I was thinking about this in like 2015, 2016, a lot of this is very like, I guess that would be wrong, 2016, 2017.
What is time?
Yeah, who knows? Especially, who knows? It's been a wild couple of years. Anyways, yeah. So there were just like not a ton of easy to find actual play podcasts that were not like high fantasy. And I'm like, This is like a lot of these are very good, but I want to like, I think it would be cool to see something more like that. So of course, like me being me, I'm like, I should make it. And then I started looking for games, and I knew that I wanted it to be PBTA because it clicked with me a lot better than most of the other stuff that I had like looked at or tried.
Yeah.
At which I say, like, I had had, you know, I think I had played like one-off PBTA game maybe that was like a pickup game over Skype or Discord, and then all of my other experience was like I had been playing D&D for like maybe a year very intermittently. But yeah, so when I started looking for something that would work for what I had in mind, with like I couldn't really find very many PBTA games that like kind of fit it. I liked a lot of the style of like the sprawl moves, but the playbooks were, you know, since I explicitly wanted magic to be in the world, like the playbooks like didn't really fit. And I liked some of the playbooks of Urban Shadows, but like the corruption mechanic kind of rubbed me the wrong way. Like,
yeah.
And after I've talked about it some with like Brendan, Leon Gambetta. Mm-hmm. And he like the way that he talks about, he's freaking brilliant. And he's helped me like I understand Urban Shadows as far as like the themes and how the mechanics play into that better. Because Urban Shadows is about gentrification. And so like there is, you know, like there is a point when it comes to gentrification where like a character, like a person or a neighborhood, like becomes irredeemable or very close to it. And once I understood that, I'm like, oh, okay. But when I'm playing it, especially with me playing it, like magic is almost always a metaphor for like queerness, or it's very linked to me, especially growing up where and when I did, to like being othered in some way. So to have like corruption moves that are linked explicitly in many cases to magic, especially since like, you know, we explicitly talk about in one of the world building episodes about like it is being sort of like, you know, in almost an in world metaphor for queerness. It's like, okay, like I don't see a way to use this without it being super gross. And also like having a character become corrupted beyond redemption is just like not really the kind of story that I want to tell. Like it feels, I do understand the intent behind it more now, but it still feel like I definitely still have a bit of a knee jerk reaction where it feels very Puritan to me, like very, again, like very fundamentalist Christian. And growing up where and when I did, it's hard not to have like, oh, no, thank you kind of thing to that.
I think I tend to agree with like most corruption mechanics upset me, especially like if you get into like I mean, it has a whole other problem, but Lovecraftian horror and insanity, corruption and stuff. I tend to generally have the knee-jerk reaction. Even, like you said, when with Urban Shadows, where it's implemented in the way that, like, this is, it has a legitimate reason why it's there, and it does tell the story, help tell the story they're trying to tell. I can appreciate that and then still not want to interact with it.
Yeah.
Just like, the first thing I throw out if I ever run D&D is the alignment system. Fuck that. I don't want it.
Oh, man.
Go away.
I have like a whole fucking rant. Like I also realize that this is kind of me being basically that like philosophy bro that nobody wants to talk to at parties. But like the alignment system fundamentally, while I also do joke about like, you know, like fairly consistently refer to myself as like chaotic good, it's like the alignment system as it's written just doesn't really. No. It doesn't, it's just, it's a big, the world building shortcoming, I feel like, because people just use it and they don't think about, and granted, I know that this is like really meta because obviously the alignment system doesn't exist like in the world, like somebody in world is not going to be like, oh yes, I am lawful good. But you as
except
like the world creator
constantly do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And like, and you as the world builder and as the person that's like facilitating the story, you should be sitting down and being like, okay, so like if someone says they're lawful good, like, what does that, and you can actually, if someone can be lawful good and actually be lawful good, like, what does that say about the world? Because, and I know that this is not an original take, but like, what do you do when something is illegal, but also the right thing, like the right thing to do? This is not an uncommon occurrence in our world where like doing something illegal is the right thing to do, or doing something legal doesn't necessarily mean that you aren't being a horrible human being. Like, so if you're going to have a lawful good character at your table, like you better be pushing back on, like, I think that people should be pushing back on and being like, okay, so when presented with like these choices, like, is it the law or is it goodness that's more important to you? And like, what does that story look like?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the alignment system was a useful shorthand for people who had never, like, people getting out of wargaming.
Yeah.
Like, here's a quick and simple way to actually give your character some kind of fucking depth. But I think we've evolved to the point in gaming where it's a weird structure. It's a weird sacred cow. I always fucking use this term and I forget if it's calf or cow.
Yeah, I know.
But I do think we should. Anyways,
when I think it's like, I think it's a good way. So one of the things that that Austin talks about, Austin Walker from Friends at the Table talks about in their like behind the scenes Tips at the Table series, which is like, you know, basically like a Q&A series on gaming. One of the things that he talks about is like ways for players to sort of like flag to the DM, which, you know, and then the DM ideally should be like adjusting the story and the world to match that. So like, if, you know, someone says like my character is lawful good or whatever, like that can, again, this very much depends on like the player and their background, but like that does potentially send a flag to the DM about what kind of a story that they might be interested in, or like what kind of events they're interested in. And so that's something that the DM can take into account. But I also feel like there's a really good Twitter thread, which I will send you, about interactive storytelling, and it's written by someone who worked on video games, but like he has like a 3-act story structure. And one of the things he talks about is like in act one, the game in this case should be like, so the idea is that like you make the player, like decide something about the character or about the world, and then the game or the story should be set up to sort of like push on that assumption and be like, is that really what you think though? Is that really how you feel? Like, why is it that you feel that way? And then sort of unfold from there. And I think that that's something that like DMs can incorporate, and that's like a way that it could be useful maybe, but it's also hard because that's going to depend, because there are definitely people in our world today who like who have Blue Lives Matters bumper stickers and think being lawful good is like an actual real thing that does not come with any complications. That's where knowing the people you're playing with comes in handy, I guess.
Yeah. Also, I'm a huge advocate for being very careful about who you play games with.
Yeah.
But that's, I could have a whole podcast about game, like getting a group of gamers together.
Yeah.
But, so now that we've broken the ice for 36 minutes, we're going to get into the changelog, which is just, lucky for you, Michelle, I rewrote the whole fucking book. And so actually getting into like the minutia of what I changed would take entirely too long. So we're going to gloss over it. I changed a lot of terms just to make it easier. I found that it's a real struggle to like name everything, but not name it something too similar to something else, or name it something that's going to evoke the same mental image in everybody's brain. And it led to me at the beginning, I was like, I'm going to name these things cool, not cool things, but like evocative things.
Yeah.
It turns out when you use evocative words,
nobody knows what you mean.
Nope.
Yeah, that's another marketing thing we learn early on, unfortunately.
So I've changed a lot of things and made it a little more uniform in an effort to like make it more understandable. I want my game to be accessible. It is a more crunchy, it's on the crunchier end of games. Like it's definitely further into crunch than like PBTA is, for instance, but not so much as like D&D and FFG Star Wars, which, you know, there's nothing. I like crunchy games, but I'm not going to make one.
It's too much math. I like when I started doing some game writing research, I like the first thing I came across was for people building off of like a D20 system. And I was like, oh, this is why everybody writes for like PBTA or Forged in the Dark, because this is too much. This is statistics. I don't want this. Please.
That is something I absolutely love about PBTA is the math is simple. You've got a bell curve. Bell curves are easy to understand. And then if the thing you want to happen most, assign to this spot, and then
yeah,
and then go from there. And it also, like, on the guess what, GM, you don't fucking roll dice. You don't. Just get rid of all that. You just get to make it up as you go.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do like a bit more a crunch than that in some of my games, and like, it's what I'm going for here. So it's a little more tactical, but not tactical. It's tactical sounds...
Mathy?
Yeah, which it's not. It is mathy, but all you do is add. You add two dice together and compare them to another two dice, and if it's higher, you win.
Yeah, that seems doable.
But yeah, it's... a bunch of change, a bunch of names. I expanded a bunch of things to make them more clear for people. Also, just put in some stuff that maybe I didn't put in there just to get it to a playable state. because I'm GMing. They don't need to know that I'm making up half of it.
Right? Yeah. That's my whole goal with this thing. I'm like, well, if I can create, like, a version one of the playbooks and the moves and the currency mechanics... See, I'm already talking myself. When I start the sentence, it sounds reasonable. If I create version one of the playbooks, and then it's like, yeah, but also. But they don't need to know that there's no GM manual yet.
Yeah, there's also no lore in my book yet. So that's just all up in the noggin, and I hope I don't forget it all.
Yeah.
So I keep it there because, especially during this stage, I don't want to... Actually, for the game itself, I also don't want to establish, like, a concrete world. I think the best kind of lore you can get are things that are like, here's all the stuff that you can play with, but don't have to if you don't want to. You can make it up yourself if you want.
Yeah.
So that's going to be... I'm going to have it all there, because I know some people need... it's why people play with pre-generated scenarios and stuff, is they're either not confident enough to do it on their own, or they just don't want to. It's just a level of interaction they don't want. So I'm going to have that in there, but also, like, with the caveat of just ignore this shit if you have a better idea, because Lord knows I'm not a masterclass writer. Right? plus, again, I like collaborative world building, and I think people should have it in their games, and people should do it with my game. So, the only two changes I really need to talk about are, because it's going to throw people for a loop, plot, which was a skill, is now just a thing. It's just a mechanic. Leadership is the skill now, and you use leadership to set up plots. Because that was confusing for fucking everyone. Which is, I kept it in for so long because I'm like, well, maybe I'm just not explaining it well enough. No, Christopher, your brain is just fucking broken. And if you just name it what it is and then use a different mechanic for what you're trying to make it useful for, people will understand it better.
Who knew?
And then I just didn't, I only had, rules for, like, adversaries, and not any rules for hazards at all. Like, there was no... If you were gonna, like, jump through a burning building, I had no rules for that. So I've come up with hazard rules. that way, like, anybody playtesting it on their own have something to put in there. And it's pretty simple. It's like... you have a certain die, so in Hard Space Hustle, you use D4s through D12s. There's no pluses or minuses or anything. It's just the dice. And so when you set up a hazard, you set the difficulty from 1 to 3, and that's the difficulty to avoid the hazard entirely. And then you also set a severity of it from a D4 to a D12, and that's what you roll if you fail or ignore the hazard to see how much damage or what it fucks up. So it's very simple. I want to keep it streamlined. That way it doesn't take a million years to sort out, like, poison saves and stuff. But those are the only two major additions to the game, as it is, other than just fixing a bunch of shit that I didn't know was broken when I wrote it the first time.
That's just writing in general, though.
I've because I hate myself, I have stolen a, you know who Delilah S. Dawson is?
The name sounds familiar, but I don't have, like, an image to go with it.
She's a writer. She's a novelist, an author. I know her from, she wrote the Captain Phasma book, so I'm a huge Captain Phasma fan, so I read the book. And I think she's written a few other Star Wars books, and a bunch of her own. But the way she writes books is, she writes her entire book in one go, and then opens up another Word file and just rewrites the book. And she does this like 3 or 4 times.
Oh, no. So, I hate that.
I know. But my problem is, if I try to just read through and fix things, I'll just skim because I'm a monster.
Yeah, I have to print it out. Like, if I'm going to do that kind of, especially with like my shorter podcasts scripts, that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But like, if it's something like that, yeah, it has to be printed, or like, yeah, my brain just looks at a computer screen and is like, oh, we skimmed this. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. I have the exact same thing. Luckily, my game at this point is only 80 pages. So,
well, that's good.
Yeah, it's not, it's just doing it. But thank you for coming along with me through my changelog. we are current, now we're to the fun part. Where I take this crown off of my shelf and give it to you and make you the monarch of all games. So congratulations.
You've
been appointed monarch of all games. And you get to make one decree before I usurp your throne again. But your decree stays in place. So, and everybody, all gamers everywhere, have to follow your decree. It could be changing a mechanic, it could be changing the path of gaming in general, or the culture, or whatever you want. You're the monarch. I can't make the rules anymore. If you could make one decree, what would it be?
I've been trying to think about this like the whole time, even as I've been talking, because I'm like, I need to come up with something really good. But I don't, like, I feel probably something around world building. I'm having some trouble with the specific wording here, but I think it's something like, like considering the implications and world building, like the thing that we talked about with the lawful good. I think that, like, considering when building your gaming world and the stories and mechanics that, like, interact with that, whether is it like a DM or like actually writing the game, make sure that you're considering the ramifications of how all of those things interact with each other, and like try very hard to take a couple steps back and inspect like where your cultural or religious or like societal experiences and like the water that you're swimming in is coloring what you're creating. Because if you can take a couple steps back from that, then I think that you will find interesting things both that will come up in gameplay, but you'll also have more fun once you can kind of remove some of that stuff and come up with something that is much more different.
So
that's like not being, that's not a decree, but
well, I think you can distill it down to like be more mindful of the implications of your world building.
Perhaps. Yeah, something like that.
So I'm going to thank you very much. I'll take this crown back.
Thanks.
Put it on the shelf.
I had it for such a short time.
To be fair, the gaming community is very fraught, and if you stay the monarch too long, you'll probably get assassinated. So
that's fair.
Doing True. You a favor here. but no, I think it's important. And it's a thing I struggle with. I've talked to, I had Quinn Wilson on here, and they, said kind of not the same thing. I don't think theirs was quite in the realm of specifically world building, but like being more mindful of the themes that you're trying to put forward. And I think it's something I struggle with because I'm generally a pretty concrete minded person. And it takes a lot for me to like think beyond the surface level of things because I'm not going to insult myself.
It's really hard. And there are definitely like, I think that the only reason honestly that it's so top of mind for me all the time is because of like default cultural Christianity. It comes mm-hmm. because that affects, since I love to consume like sci-fi and fantasy, it is always really interesting to me when I read a book or something that like has polytheism in it, and it is super, super apparent when the author has never like when the author has not done any research on what polytheistic practices or even animism or ancestor veneration, like any of these things, right. what they look like in practice, or like how people are doing them. And when they're, it's very obvious when like someone has done that versus someone like, you know, like, just like having read the D&D manual or whatever. There's a line in like the Avengers, the first Avengers movie, that is like a really good example of this. And also like one of the many case studies for why Joss Whedon doesn't understand these characters. And it's also funny since Joss Whedon's whole shtick is that he's like an atheist and like not Christian, but it's a very good example of cultural Christianity when like, when, you know, somebody says something about Thor, Black Widow says something about Thor, and Captain America's like, there's only one God, ma'am, and he doesn't look like that. And it's like, what? But also like that's unnecessary. And this whole like the portrayal of like Loki as like a Satan type figure is just like completely, again, I do understand that these are comic book characters, but like it's something,
it doesn't make it less important.
Yeah. Well, and you see it in pagan communities too. So like everybody is prone to fall to it, and it takes like literal, like I said, the only reason that this stuff, that I think about this stuff so much, is because I've been pagan since I was like, you know, 11 or 12, and like stumbled across the right space on the internet, and now I'm like 30, so
there's a lot of, no matter where what background or situation you come from, there's a lot of deprogramming you have to go through. Well, you don't have to, but I think like there are some cases where it's very important.
Yeah. And to do that level of like unpacking. So I certainly do not mean to sound like I have it all figured out, because like, you know, as a white person who grew up in America, like definitely have huge blind spots. But it is something that is interesting. And the cultural Christianity just comes to mind because it comes up so often in fantasy, but like there are a million, you know, the lawful good thing. Like if you're talking to someone who has never had an unpleasant experience with law enforcement or has never, you know, I could go off on a whole other thing there, but if you're talking to somebody who has a certain set of experiences, that like, that's probably not even going to occur to them.
No. And like, there's no, like, I'm not trying to throw shade on people. I have problems too. I have a lot of different things I need to unpack. But the important thing is, I think, to be aware of the fact that you have certain cultural inclinations ingrained in you, and to question them a little more than maybe you are already.
Yeah.
This is the royal you, not you specifically.
Oh, I gotcha.
Me.
Us.
But no, I agree. I think we've gone off on a huge tangent here.
Yeah, sorry.
But no. It's all stuff I super agree with. I think that's good. I think we got there. Mm-hmm. I think we got everything.
Yes, I think so.
Thank you so much for coming on my podcast. This was wonderful.
Test complete.
So I have a work in progress game, which I'm hoping to get up on Itch sometime in the next month or two. I'm not sure when this is going to go out or when it will be up, but you will be able to find a link to that on my social primarily. I'm most active on Twitter, where I am at _shellshock, CHELLESHOCK. You can find a list of all of my projects at michellenikolaisen.com, which is also linked to on Twitter because I know that's a mouthful. Serendipity City is at serendipitypod.com. My other podcast, Unplaced, is at unplacedpodcast.com. And there will be updates on all of the game projects at all of those places. So you can find me there.
A big thank you to Matt Lee for our intro and outro music. Follow him at Nice Wizard Music. Support us by following on Twitter at PlaytestPod. Download all current documents for this game at playtest.pub, and find a link to our Discord from either of those to join our creative, friendly community. And remember, everyone, together we can seize the day and just make the things we want to make without waiting for permission. know you were worried about talking too much, but this has honestly been one of the least stressful ones for me because I always worry I'm talking too much.
I do get that piece of feedback sometimes. Sometimes I'm like, sorry, I'm sorry that we got coffee and I've been talking for 90 minutes straight. I work at home and I haven't left the house all week. And the other person's like, no, it's great. Like, I don't have any pressure right now.
It's been wonderful.
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, okay. That's a very positive spin on it. Thank you.